From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! This woman's work is never done. A conversation with the head of the newly created women's department of the AFL-CIO. She also founded 9 to 5. And a look at where the country's nuclear wastes are deposited, plans for new sites, and the struggles against them in Nevada, Washington State, and California.
All of Southern California, which receives its water from the Colorado River through the Metropolitan Water District's aqueduct, were completely oblivious as to the Ward Valley project, the proposed low reactive waste dump, and were completely unaware of any potential of contamination through seepage into the aquifers, and which ultimately lead to the Colorado River. The company that's the operator for the low-level radioactive waste dump is U.S. Ecology, which itself has a terrible track record and has left a legacy of contamination wherever it's been. And that's what we're trying to do, is protect the Colorado River and the public from this menace.
All this and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. No mining, no testing, no production, no dumping, no nukes. That's the rallying cry of next week's Nuclear Abolition Summit in Las Vegas. On our weekly segment, Living Democracy, we'll have a discussion of nuclear issues in this week's three presidential primary states, Nevada, Washington, and California, where activists are fighting the Yucca Mountain, Hanford, and Ward Valley nuclear waste sites. But first, we look at women's work. Often when people think of health and safety in the workplace, they think of dangerous industries like mining, steel, and construction that have tended to be male-dominated. Today, however, many of the new health and safety challenges are in areas like poultry processing and offices where repetitive motion syndrome or carpal tunnel syndrome plagues its workers. These are industries dominated by women. Today, we'll talk about women's work with a pioneer in the struggle for working women's rights. Karen Nussbaum founded 9 to 5, the National Association of Working Women, in 1973. It's an organization that represents women office workers. 20 years later, President Clinton appointed her to head the Women's Bureau at the Department of Labor. Now Nussbaum has left the administration to head up a new women's department of the AFL-CIO. It was created by the union to reach out to women workers who make up an increasing number of temporary workers, workers in heavy industry, and workers forming unions. We're also joined by Laura Flanders. She's head of the Women's Bureau of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, a media watch group here in New York City. And she's going to join in the discussion and focus on how women's work issues are covered in the media. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having us.
Well, why don't we begin with Karen Nussbaum in Washington. Let's see, you came to your job at the AFL-CIO just barely a month ago. What issues are you planning to address there?
There's no issue that I'm not addressing. President Sweeney, the new president at the AFL-CIO, brought me in so that women's concerns will be injected in every nook and cranny of the labor movement, as he said. And for what that means for me right now is that in a huge campaign called America Needs a Raise, that we're going to be talking about why working women think America needs a raise, what that means to us, how hard it is for us to make ends meet. It means that when we conduct Union Summer, where 1,000 young people will be working on union campaigns all over, that there'll be probably a majority of young women who are working on that, organizing women. And it also means, maybe most importantly this year, that politics is going to be about working women's concerns, and we're going to be sure that we're talking to working women in a way that, means something to them.
Why did you feel you could do more at the AFL-CIO than you could at the Department of Labor?
Well, I loved my job at the Department of Labor. It gave me a wonderful opportunity to talk with women all over the country in just about every kind of job. I met with temporary workers in Boston and executives in Los Angeles and poultry workers in Mississippi and airline flight attendants in Chicago. And what I heard from them was that they are very eloquent about what their problems are. We know what's wrong on the job. And surprisingly, though they're working conditions couldn't have been more different. Their problems, their concerns were really very much the same. But to a person, they had very little idea about what to do about those problems. And it seemed to me that what we needed to be doing was finding the power that would make those changes. And that really has to come from outside the government.
Laura Flanders, over at FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, where you head up the Women's Bureau there, you've been doing a lot of work on how the media covers women's issues, and I think it's why we have a lot of the misconceptions we do about women. And in a recent issue of On the Issues, that's the latest issue of this magazine, you quoted one person who had a very interesting comment to make, who was talking about the massacre of the weakest.
Yes, that was actually Marion Wright Edelman's comment to the New York Times last fall when she talked about the effect of the budget on people in this country. The budget, as you recall, was reported mainly as a kind of problem of political wrangling in Washington, D.C. And she was trying to say, look, this isn't about any kind of, you know, verbal fistfight going on in D.C. What's happening is immoral. What's happening is a potential revolution. And it was my contention in that article that we might see people in this country more motivated to protest around budget questions and economic questions if we reported those questions, economic questions, as often from a woman's point of view as we report them from the point of view of Wall Street. You know that every evening the dips and falls of the Dow Jones Index are reported in such a way as to provide a very kind of vigorous and exciting picture, which is really of interest only to a minority of people. At the same time, the economy and the effect of economic changes on women, which affects a vast population in this country, somehow avoids scrutiny, such that, for example, the many month-long struggle at the Diamond Walnut strike in California had received, up until the point that Karen Nussbaum went out to visit that strike, it had received precisely, I think, two mentions and no focus story in the New York Times. And so it required a member of the administration to go there and report it. And it's my feeling in this article that, you know, in the fall of last year, we saw tens of thousands of people in the streets of France. Right now, this month, we're seeing tens of thousands protesting budget cuts in Bolivia. I think we would see more people mobilized to protest and defend their interests if women weren't so scrupulously cut out of the reporting.
Karen Nussbaum, let me ask you today. Democrats are trying again today in the House and the Senate to vote on raising the minimum wage. Can you talk about the minimum wage and women workers?
I can. And in fact, it fits right in with Laura's point, which is that last night I was on a television show with a guy who heads up a business think tank. And we're talking about the minimum wage, and I'm saying, you know, a majority of workers on minimum wage are women, and what that means is that they can't buy shoes for their children, and they can't, you know, go to the dentist, send anyone in their family to the dentist. And if you would just raise the minimum wage, this 90 cents, that means that they could buy groceries for 7 months for their family. And he kept saying, 67% of economists say that there'll be a dip in the blah, 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 you know, and, you know, what does that mean to anybody? First of all, it wasn't true, but also it just doesn't mean anything to anybody. What does mean something to people is, how am I going to make ends meet? How am I going to pay this bill? Why do I have to work three jobs to just get by?
One of the things that FAIR studied not long ago, I guess it was about 3 years ago, we did a three-month study of the coverage of NAFTA. And we found that here, this trade pact, the North American Free Trade Agreement, that was going to have its impact first and foremost on working women, North and South, those who are the majority of workers in the multinational industries in Mexico, and those, too, who are working in the industries that were possibly at risk of being displaced in this country. They're women. And yet, in those 3 months of reporting, we found not one working woman quoted, not one. And that's not asking for any favors from reporters. That's just asking them to go to the source of the story, to go to the people who will be primarily affected. It's just asking for the reporting to be done right, not different.
Well, you know, that leads us to an interesting question for Karen Nussbaum, who's now heading up the new women's department of the AFL-CIO, came from the Clinton administration's Department of Labor. How does it feel to go from a very pro-NAFTA environment to a very anti-NAFTA one, and where do you stand?
Oh, well, as part of the labor movement, I'm opposed to NAFTA, and I've seen what it has done and what it is doing to working women and to workers in all the industries that are affected. But I think that the way Laura is posing it is really so interesting and so important that unless you speak to women deliberately, you can be sure you're not speaking to women. And there is such a prejudice in campaigns, in policymaking, in those who deliver messages that even though they know it, and even though the polls will tell you if you speak to women, you still hit men, men can hear you. But if you're talking only to men, it goes right by women because you're just bypassing them. They still won't change the way they deliver the message. And that's true about NAFTA. It's true about minimum wage. It's true about just about anything that you want to talk about.
But what was it like to be anti-NAFTA then in the department?
You know, in the Women's Bureau, I really had a lot of freedom to work on the issues that directly affected women in the way that that I saw fit. And so, frankly, I really never was called upon to talk about NAFTA, and it didn't enter my work. So, and the other thing is that as a member of any organization, you operate within the confines of that organization. That's part of the rules, and I abide by those rules. I may have differences with some of the opinions in the AFL-CIO, but they're arrived at in a democratic fashion. But overall, I'm delighted to be in the labor movement. I think that it speaks genuinely for the concerns of working people.
We're talking to Karen Nussbaum, who is currently heading up the newly created women's department of the AFL-CIO. She formerly founded 9to5, the National Association of Working Women, and worked in the Clinton administration's Department of Labor, their Women's Bureau. What about setting up a women's department in the AFL-CIO? Does that marginalize women's issues?
Well, you know, that can be true. Sometimes organizations will set up the women's department or the civil rights department in order to be able to check it off on their list. Okay, now we've done that. Now we don't have to worry about it. I don't think it's going to be true in this case because of the kind of person John Sweeney is and his track record. I've worked with John Sweeney for 20 years, and I don't think he ever, you know, his intention and his actions were never to marginalize the work I did or others like me. And I think also that if what you wanted to do was just say, okay, we've taken care of women, then I would be a big pain in the neck. You wouldn't want to hire me because that's not the way I've done my work. That's not the way I've operated in the past. There is a genuine commitment. It's being seen in every department. And I think that this is a real case where establishing for the very first time a working women's department is going to mean real change.
I had a question, Karen Nussbaum, about the history, the track record of the Clinton administration when it comes to women workers. Throughout the budget battles of last year, we were given the impression that Clinton was kind of the defender of the working person against the evil budget cutters. And yet when I looked a little bit deeper at what had been happening for women workers across the United States under the proposals that Clinton himself had put on the table, it was not such a cheery picture. I'm thinking in particular of Al Gore's program for relaxing government regulations, the common sense government approach that was going to have a major impact on OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, such that the memories that Clinton evoked in his presidential bid, his campaign in 1992, and his reference to the 1991 North Carolina Hamlet chicken fire factory. Remember that time when he reminded
Yes.
everybody of the people who had been killed, the women who had been killed, locked into that chicken factory? It seems as if that the image and the reality have been different throughout the administration, and I'm wondering if you can talk about that a little bit.
Yes, I am proud of what the Clinton administration has done for working people in the budget process. I think that you can't underestimate how the Republican takeover of the Congress constrains what is possible to do. And what isn't seen is that at a time when, for example, OSHA was the Republicans were calling for a one-third cut in the budget of OSHA, The Clinton administration was calling for increasing enforcement at a time when the Republicans are calling for cutting the wage and hour division of the Department of Labor, which enforces minimum wage, which is trying its utmost to eliminate sweatshops in the garment industry. The Republicans wanted to cut it by, I think, nearly 20%. The Clinton administration is calling for increasing the enforcement budget. These are very tough times. The range of the debate is so incredibly narrow that that any proposals couldn't possibly do what we need to do. That's why we need a more powerful labor movement. There's not enough room for a genuine debate. And until we, from the outside, working people can say, what you're talking about doesn't begin to address the problems. We need real safety and health. We want to make sure that there are no sweatshops in this country. We have to stop the epidemic of repetitive strain injury, which affects every kind of worker in this country and is genuinely an epidemic. You know, whether you're talking about a 5% cut or a 25% cut is not even a debate that makes any that is meaningful for working people. And we need to change the very overall terms of the debate.
You know, I want to get to where women are working in this country, what industries, but I want to stick to this point for a minute, what makes people so cynical about what's going on in Congress with the Republicans and the Democrats. I mean, I remember when I was covering the first 100 days of Congress, when the Democrats stepped forward and said, we have to increase the minimum wage. I mean, today they're talking about increasing it 90 cents over the next 2 years to $5.15, I believe. When the Democrats were in the majority for the first 2 years of the Clinton administration, they did not increase the minimum wage when they had the possibility of doing it. Then when the Republicans clearly didn't want to do it in this last 2 years, that's when they put it forward. So for people outside the Beltway, they look at this and say, what kind of game playing is going on?
Well, I think there are many critiques to be made about what happened in the first 2 years. There were many opportunities missed, but also a number of very important things that were passed. But I think what it all gets back to is if we leave it to the policymakers in Washington, we lose. That's not enough of a they don't represent us well enough. And that's why at the AFL-CIO, we are staging a huge campaign called America Needs a Raise. It is about what working people care about, and it will be a campaign that we see in our contract negotiations, in our public policy debates, and it will be the way we do politics, that we are not going to endorse candidates based on their personality or promises. We are running an issues campaign called America Needs a Raise, and that's what our politics are going to be about. And that will mean minimum wage. It will mean closing the gap between the CEOs whose compensation package increased over 300% over the last 15 years, while average working people saw their salaries decline. It will mean health care reform. It will mean portable pensions. Those are the kinds of issues that we're talking about, and politics will be about issues. It will not be about personality with a revived labor movement.
What about, and we just have a minute before break, but what about where women work today? In what industries? Karen Nussbaum.
Every industry. That's what I found. I found I talked to women machinists who worked at Boeing who told me that, they have become very tough over their years of struggle, and the struggle isn't over, but they had the quiet confidence of the people who had been through tough times and know that they'd come out on the other end okay. Clerical workers are still count for more than any other kind of job for women. About a quarter of all women work as office workers of one kind or another. But women are also programmers. They are in the armed services. They are executives. They are poultry workers. They are you find them everywhere. But they are still earning less than men in just about every job category. They still carry the burden of work at home. Women still are responsible for balancing what is a smaller and smaller paycheck for their families. While they probably retain a greater sense of community, the most sense of community of people in our society. And if we want change, you can bet we need to rely on working women to make it.
We're talking to Karen Nussbaum. She has just become head of the new women's department of the AFL-CIO. We're also joined by Laura Flanders, who is head of the Women's Bureau at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, the Media Watch Group here in New York City. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's national daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman. Joining me in the studio here at Pacifica Radio's New York station, WBAI, is Laura Flanders, head of the Women's Bureau of FAIR, that's Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, in New York City. It's a media watch group, and it covers how the media covers a lot of things. Today we're talking about how it covers labor, particularly women in labor, a different kind of labor than we'll be talking about other times. And we're joined by Karen Nussbaum. Karen Nussbaum has just been named head of a newly created division of the AFL-CIO. It is the Women's Department. Before that, she worked for the Women's Bureau of the Department of Labor under President Clinton. Before that, she was co-founder of 9 to 5, the National Association of Working Women. And she also was president of District 925 of the Service Employees International Union, a national union of office and professional employees. And we thank you both again for coming to Democracy Now! In just a little while, we're going to be moving to our Living Democracy segment, where we'll be talking about nuclear waste in the three primary states this week, in Nevada, in Washington State, and in California. We'll be speaking with the chair of a Native American tribe, and we'll be speaking with activists in Washington, Nevada. What are they doing about these sites? Karen Nussbaum, talking about labor, talking about women, I wanted to ask you about 9 to 5 and what it means not to be a union, having moved from that, the non-union of working women, to heading up the SEIU District 925, which was a national union of office and professional employees.
Well, I'll tell you, what women tell me in my own experience as a clerical worker was that you confront problems on the job. You're not making enough pay. You need flexibility to drop your kids off at school and get them in the afternoon. You don't have, you know, there's no child care available, those kinds of problems. And you need help solving those problems, that it's very hard to be very effective going in as one person to your boss and saying, excuse me, could we improve the health insurance policy here? Or, pardon me, but we need child care vouchers within this company. The only way you solve those problems, or I'm being harassed sexually, or you have a policy that discriminates here. You can't solve those problems as one person. You need help. That's why we started 9 to 5, which was an organization that wasn't a union, and we soon found that in many places, just that kind of backing isn't enough, and you need the power of a majority of people in your workplace that gives you the strength of the law behind you that forces your employer to bargain with you. That's called a union. We think today at the AFL-CIO that unions are still the most effective way to help working women and working men, but that we need to reach out in every way we can. People are hungering for help. That's certainly what I found in my 3 years at the Women's Bureau. And that it's our job to meet them where they are, give them the kind of help that they need, and prove that that with some backing, you can make some change. And that's what we intend to do.
What about affirmative action? What is the AFL-CIO doing about that? Often affirmative action is portrayed as a kind of elite mechanism for women or people of color in government, corporate positions. What about blue-collar workers? How does affirmative action affect blue-collar
workers? At the Women's Bureau, we conducted a survey where we asked questions like that, and over a quarter of a million women responded to the Working Women Count survey. And what we found was that issues like pay and benefits and respect on the job, affirmative action, affected everybody. Some of the comments we got were things like a factory worker in Cleveland who said, "My head aches from bumping up against the glass ceiling." Women in every job category saying, "I have to work twice as hard just to stay where I am." It is a common story. It affects everybody. And you put together 10 random women and they'll tell you a story, which, and they may not use the term affirmative action, but they'll tell you, "I'm not treated fairly. I don't get the opportunities that I should, and it's because I'm a woman." And of course, it's even doubly true for women who are women of color, and they'll tell you that. And the white women know that too. And you know what? Their husbands know it too. There is broad support out there for treating women fairly on the job. If you talk to working people, because it's their families who suffer if they don't, and it's a high time that policies like affirmative action are understood in those everyday human kinds of terms, as opposed to phrases that are just scary, if at all meaningful, like preferential treatment. That's not what affirmative action is. Affirmative action means that the mom in the home gets paid what she should.
Laura Flanders, how do we change the image of working women in the media?
Well, I think it's a question of working on the media's approach to economy and economic questions as a whole. As work becomes more dangerous and hours longer and pay and security less, women predominantly pay the price. And when women pay the price, that's families, that's communities, that's exponentially expanded outside of the woman to whole areas of our economy. Meanwhile, when both parties are adopting this attitude that downsizing is inevitable, that insecurity should become the norm for working people, and the press echo that approach, kind of echoing the corporate concern when unemployment goes down and focusing instead on the stock market and interest rates, then you're editing out the heart of the story. And women are at the heart of the story when it comes to the economy, and that's a heart that's, you know, economic and statistical, but it's also a heart that's about the passion in our reporting and the passion to provoke people to protest and to make change and to call for new options. The French, when they protested last year, they didn't say we have an alternative plan. They said we do not accept this plan. We want you to come up with something else. The Bolivians right now are saying the same thing. This is not okay. In this country, we're often told if you don't have an alternative plan, you don't have a right to speak. And I think that's the problem, that the reporters go to the same sources for their information, the administration, the government offices, the right-wing think tanks in Washington, D.C. They do not go where the passion is, where the power is, where the ideas are. That could present us with new options, which is certainly what we need in this country and internationally.
Would you say, Karen Nussbaum, that there is skewed reporting around unions? I mean, you think about, for example, the fact corporations run newspapers, run TV outlets. They're also scared and concerned about their own unions.
Oh, absolutely. And we found that over the issue of video display terminals and what harmful effects that may have. For example, years ago, when the publishing industry put a stop to running stories about VDT injuries, it was horrifying. And of course, at the same time, reporters were suffering terribly from VDT injuries. They were having repetitive strain injury at very high rates. So you've got the Los Angeles Times installing whirlpool baths for reporters to ease their troubled wrists at the same time that there is almost a virtual ban on reporting on the problem. And then what happens is that the Congress, the Republican Congress, says that the Occupational Safety and Health Administration is prohibited from even studying the issue. So you've got reporting that's determined by economic interests of those who pay for the advertising or the publishing, And then that helps determine what goes on in Congress. And it means then that the millions, millions and millions of working people who suffer from repetitive strain injury can't even get their government to study the issue. It does mean something to us. It means it affects the reporters and the clerical workers and the poultry workers and the catfish workers, everyone throughout the country, when stories are turned into cold statistics or government data instead of, as Laura says, what this means to real people.
We're going to have to wrap up. I wanted to ask you, Karen Nussbaum, how people can get in touch with you, women who work, men who work, who are concerned about women in the workplace. What can they do?
Call us at here at Washington at 637-5000.
That's 202.
Be setting up a 202-637-5000. We're going to be setting up a hotline very shortly on America Needs a Raise. We believe that Americans both need a raise and know that we can get it. Corporate profits have never been higher, but they're just not sharing, and it's time that they did. And we are going to help Americans tell that story and make sure that that changes.
And that's Karen Nussbaum, who is now heading up the newly created women's department of the AFL-CIO. Laura Flanders of FAIR. If people are monitoring the media, want to figure out how to put pressure on the media to cover working women's lives more accurately, what can they do?
They can contact FAIR in New York at 212-633-6700, 212-633-6700, or subscribe to FAIR's Magazine Extra, or tune in to Counterspin, our weekly radio show.
I want to thank you both very much for joining us again. Karen Nussbaum from the AFL-CIO, formerly with President Clinton's Department of Labor, and before that, one of the co-founders of 9 to 5, and Laura Flanders of the Media Watch Group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting here in New York City. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, our Living Democracy segment on nuclear waste in this country. Where is it coming from and where is it going?
Washing the floors to send you to college. Staying at home so you can feel safe. What do you think is the soul of a knowledge? What do you think that makes her feel safe? Biting her lips and lowering her eyes to make sure there's food on the table. What do you think would be her surprise if the world was as willing as she's able? Hugging herself in an old kitchen chair, she listens to your hurt and your rage.
You're listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily national grassroots election show. This week, there were primaries in California, in Washington State, and Nevada. Something you didn't hear a lot about is the issue of nuclear waste. Most of the nuclear waste is concentrated in these three states. And joining us to talk about this issue are three people. Next week, anti-nuclear activists from around the world will gather in Las Vegas at the Nevada nuclear testing site to develop a cohesive plan to oppose moves by the nuclear industry on many fronts, including planned subcritical nuclear tests in Nevada, continued mining and proposed dumping of radioactive nuclear waste on indigenous lands. We're joined by Chair Matthew Lavis. He is chair of the Chemehuevi tribe in Southern California along the Colorado River, one of five tribes in the Mojave Desert who are fighting the proposed Ward Valley nuclear waste site. We're also joined by Judy Treichel, executive director of the Nevada Nuclear Waste Task Force in Las Vegas, which keeps tabs on the Nevada nuclear test site and is opposed to Yucca Mountain, the proposed national nuclear waste repository. And Tom Bailey joins us. He's a farmer in eastern Washington state and a downwinder. He's part of a class action suit against the government over the release of radioactivity from the Hanford nuclear complex there. And joining us in our studio in Washington is Bill McGavern. He heads up Public Citizen's Critical Mass Energy Project, and he is an expert on nuclear waste, how it's trafficked in this country, where it goes, where it comes from. And we want to begin with Bill McGavern to ask you to give us an overall picture right now of the nuclear waste map in this country.
Well, what's been happening is that for over 50 years, the government for its nuclear weapons and the private nuclear industry for generating nuclear power have been producing highly poisonous radioactive waste, despite the fact that they have no place to put these wastes and no way to isolate the waste from the environment for the 250,000 years during which the waste remain hazardous. So now what's happening is the nuclear industry is trying to get Congress to have the U.S. government take these highly poisonous radioactive wastes off the hands of the private utilities that have generated them and to dump the waste in places like Nevada and in Ward Valley, California, where they think that they can pick on populations that don't have the political clout to fight off the dumps. But in fact, they found that they have big fights on their hands and that people are rising up to oppose nuclear waste dumping on native lands and on politically weak states. And people are opposing the transportation of radioactive waste through heavily populated areas throughout the country. And this transportation would be necessary if members of Congress are successful in forcing the federal government to take nuclear waste off the hands of the private utilities.
Well, let's talk to some of the people who are organizing around this country. Judy Treichel, tell us about what's happening in Nevada. In fact, you were just involved with some DOE, Department of Energy hearings in Las Vegas in the last few days. Tell us about what's happening at Yucca Mountain and the Nevada nuclear test site. First of all, place it for us, for listeners who aren't even familiar with the map of Nevada.
Okay, good morning. The Nevada test site is northwest of Las Vegas. Yucca Mountain is about 85 miles northwest of Las Vegas. And as Bill McGavern has said, the waste from commercial plants that would have to come to Yucca Mountain, if it were to do so, would travel through 43 states and would almost certainly, if it goes on interstates, which the law requires that it do, would come through Las Vegas in order to get to the Yucca Mountain site. And here in Nevada, there is tremendous resistance to a national dump being built and operated at Yucca Mountain because Nevadans, even though it's a small state politically, Nevadans are certainly no stranger to things nuclear. The test site has been here since the 50s, and there there are tremendous problems as a result of what went on out there, just as there are with other weapons facilities and other nuclear facilities. And the people here feel that there is absolutely no assurance that this would be the first time ever real success story when it came to nuclear materials. There's, they've asked the Department of Energy to show us where other successful operations are, and as far as I know, there aren't any when it comes to nuclear waste, and it's all of the messes that have been created as far as the weapons facilities are concerned that they are looking to take that waste and now start another waste facility here.
Now, in the last two nights, you were involved with these Department of Energy hearings. What were they saying and what were you telling them?
Well, the majority of people who testified at the environmental impact statement hearing here concerning uses for the Nevada test site wanted it closed down as far as nuclear activities are concerned. They certainly did not want additional testing of bombs to go on out there, and they did not want nuclear activities to go on. They were very strong in trying to promote a solar energy facility to be built at that site.
Let's go to Chair Matthew Leavis. Tell us about what's going on in California. We're going to have to break in a minute, but then we will come back. Chair Matthew Leavis, chair of the Chemehuevi tribe in Southern California.
Yes, my name is Matthew Leavis, senior tribal chairman for the Chemehuevi Indian tribe.
Can you speak as loud as you can because we're having a little trouble hearing you?
Okay. Well, our res- reservation is located 20 miles east of the Ward Valley, and the Ward Valley is situated in the Mojave Desert. If anybody's familiar with Southern California, Needles, California is north of us, and the Fort Mojave Indian Reservation is in that general area, which is 18 miles from the Ward Valley site. The tribes, Fort Mojave and Chemehuevi tribe, have been leading the fight against the Ward Valley, and we've requested assistance from the other lower basin tribes, the Colorado River Indian tribes, the Quichan tribe down in Yuma, and the Kokopa tribe, to fight against the Ward Valley. And back in August of 95, we've signed a joint resolution to the Secretary of Interior, Babbitt, placing him a notice that the tribes were very disturbed about him bypassing the process of the government-to-government relationship, and we feel that he has breached the trust responsibility of the Department of Interior by not involving the tribes and informing the tribes of the hazards and the potential of a contamination if the Ward Valley leaked into the aquifer. And there's been some studies done regarding the geology of the area, and there's been the Wilshire report, which came out, which has been very useful to us, but identifies the different paths that water can flow from the Ward Valley into the Colorado River, one being up through Needles area, the other one coming through our area.
We're going to talk about that report in just a second, but we do have to break. You're listening to Chair Matthew Lavis of the Chemehuevi Tribe in Southern California. And we're going to come back to Tom Bailey, who is in Washington State, and we're going to talk about Hanford as well, and then what people are doing overall around this country to battle the trafficking of nuclear waste and also where it's being deposited. You're listening to Democracy Now! You're listening to Democracy Now!, and we're moving on with our Living Democracy segment, taking a look at how grassroots activists around this country are taking issues into their own hands. Today, it's the issue of nuclear waste. I'm Amy Goodman, and we're joined by four guests. In our Washington studio, we've got Bill McGavern. He's head of Public Citizen's Critical Mass Energy Project. Out in Washington State, Tom Bailey, a farmer in eastern Washington. Judy Treichel is with us from Nevada, executive director of the Nevada Nuclear Waste Task Force. And we're also joined by Chair Matthew Lavis, chair of the Chemehuevi Tribe in Southern California. I want to get back to what you said, Chair Lavis, but I want to also move on to Tom Bailey in eastern Washington. He's a downwinder who's part of a class action suit against the government over the release of radioactivity from the Hanford nuclear complex. I've got a book here called The Greenpeace Book of the Nuclear Age, The Hidden History, The Human Cost by John May. And this is how he describes Hanford. He says it was one of three atomic cities built at high speed as part of the Manhattan Project. Beginning in 1943, a remote site contained within a bend of the Columbia River in the desolate southeast of Washington State was transformed by 40,000 workers into a 570-square-mile nuclear city, and work was begun on the three reactors that were to produce plutonium for the first atomic test explosion and the Nagasaki bomb. A further five reactors were built on the site in the following decade, and these continued to operate until all eight were closed down between 1964 and 71. By that time, they'd produced 50 tons of weapons-grade plutonium, enough to build 1,000 Nagasaki-equivalent bombs, which has been used for over half the weapons in the U.S. arsenal. Tom Bailey, you grew up outside the fence of the Hanford complex. How did it affect you?
Well, Amy, Hanford's releases and the toxic waste that they released from there affected all the families around here in the form of thyroid cancers, colon cancers, deformed children, deformed farm animals. We're just finding out about all of this, and that's why we're suing the government now for those harmful effects they've done to the people here.
How did it affect you personally and your family?
Well, as a child, I was born with birth defects. I'm sterile. I had chloracne all over my skin when I was 6 years old. And I can go into a litany of ugly illnesses. But the bottom line is most of our families had cancer.
Cancer.
Cancer mainly, yes.
What about the radioactive releases that have just come out in the last 10 years under Freedom of Information Act requests? Can you tell us what the Green Run was?
Well, in 1949, the government released the Green Run, which was a huge release of radioactive iodine-131. It was released out on top of us deliberately, and it was one of the largest releases in the history of the free world. And nobody's really been able to tell us why they did it to us yet.
And how did it affect people in the ways that you've just described?
Iodine-131 seeks the thyroid, and it causes the thyroid to become dysfunctional. And the thyroid is a real important gland. I'm not a doctor. I'm just a simple farmer. But without it, your life is just screwed up.
Tom Bailey, a farmer in eastern Washington, grows potatoes and wheat and corn. Did you move far away from the Hanford site with your family?
No, we stayed right here. We were here before Hanford came. You know, Hanford was America's bomb factory during the Cold War. Like all industries, it made a lot of waste, Amy. But this was really dangerous and toxic waste. It's just now an industrial age relic, and it's an atomic garbage dump for radioactive materials and people. And it's on the fast track becoming America's first national sacrifice zone. And I get a kick out of listening to people talk about, well, the DOE says maybe it'll do this, maybe it won't. We're going to have the environmental hearings. It's all happened at Hanford. Our groundwater's crapped up. It's contaminated with iodine-129, 127, and technetium. Cesium, they crapped up the air. They harmed the environment, the people, the water, the animals, the deformed sheep that we had here, the deformed calves. It's all been done at Hanford. And you just better not trust the Department of Energy.
How is the waste stored there at Hanford now?
Well, there's various... various methods. Some of it's in liquid waste and tanks that that have blown and leaked into the aquifers. But mainly they just keep digging the same thing they did in the 40s. They dig great big ditches, and they just dump it in these ditches and keep burying it. You know, 600 acres at a shot, 600 acres at a shot, over and over. They give it new names and just throw more millions of dollars at it. But it's, the bottom line, it's just a big radioactive garbage dump.
Chair Matthew Lavis, chair of the Chemehuevi tribe in Southern California, what do you think as you listen to Tom Bailey describe what's already happened in eastern Washington as you battle this low-level radioactive waste to be the government would like to site in Ward Valley, California?
Well, I'm familiar with Hanford. I've been up to Hanford to visit the site and primarily to visit the low-level radioactive waste facility, which is operated by U.S. Ecology. And truthfully, I was amazed to see the size of the facility and the size of containers that were down inside the pit. And this was an unlined pit with various sizes of containers. And
is Cooper there? Bailey.
Go ahead.
Yes, but at any rate, I know about the contamination. I know about the problems that they've had up there.
Zach?
And beyond that, you know, we support
Cooper.
We support the people in their fight against
what else should I say?
Fight. And we feel
all right.
We feel
the human
Tom Bailey, I have to ask you to please not speak into the telephone because we can hear you.
Okay.
We feel that we could be faced with the same potential hazard here on the lower Colorado River with Ward Valley, and we feel that we also would have impacts from the Nevada Test Site. Nevada Test Site and Ward Valley are part of the traditional roaming areas of our people, part of our territory. And our people know much about the area and about the subterranean tunnels that lead from one place to another, and we feel that there's already been contamination from the Nevada Test Site into the Colorado River.
Bill McGavern, does that make sense to you in Washington at the Public Citizens Critical Mass Energy Project?
Well, you know, what's happening here in the political cesspool of Washington, D.C. really could result in more of the kinds of radiation exposures that have been inflicted on Tom Bailey and his family. It could happen again in Nevada. It could happen again in California if the nuclear industry has its way. The industry has been pouring millions of dollars in campaign contributions to members of Congress, and, of course, they lately have tilted those more towards the Republicans. And the Republicans want to reward the industry, give it some return on its investment. And there are a few things standing in their way. One is the Clinton administration, which hasn't really taken a position on these dumping proposals and wants to please both sides, but so far has at least said that it wants to do scientific studies before agreeing to radioactive waste dumps in Nevada and in California. Now, that's not a whole lot for us to rest on, so citizens have to mobilize around the country. And Senator Richard Bryan from Nevada and Senator Barbara Boxer from California have been strongly opposing these industry dumping proposals. And citizens also in those states and around the country have been telling their members of Congress that they don't want a bailout of the nuclear industry at the expense of our health and our children's health.
You had an interesting, I don't know if you want to say gimmick or idea that occurred during the middle of the month, this idea of hugging a nuclear lobbyist. Can you explain that, Bill McGavern?
Well, there was actually a day in the Senate Energy Committee a few weeks ago that we named Hug a Nuclear Lobbyist Day, because on the same day the committee approved two different pieces of legislation. One was to speed the opening of a nuclear waste dump in Nevada with reduced environment, health, and safety controls, and to start transportation of high-level radioactive waste through 43 states in this country, and that was approved in committee. And the other one was to force the federal government to give the state of California the land at Ward Valley near the Chemehuevi tribe, so that that land could be used as a radioactive waste dump by the state of California and a contractor, U.S. Ecology, that has already been guilty of illegal dumping in Nevada. So it was such a giveaway to the industry in the Senate Energy Committee that we named it Hug a Nuclear Lobbyist Day, and that's pretty much what happened. And now we're fighting to keep those bills from passing through the Congress.
Judy Treichel, tell us how you organize in Nevada, both around Yucca Mountain and also around the Nevada nuclear waste, the Nevada test site, where, in fact, some testing is going to be going on in the next few months.
Well, in Nevada, it's hardly necessary to organize against something like this. What the people are really asking for, they oppose the project, and what they're asking for is a democratic process, a process where the people of the country make a decision that they feel is in their best interest, that they feel really solves a problem. And what we're seeing with this situation is that nuclear waste and democracy don't seem to be able to coexist. When the government has been here in southern Nevada talking about the proposal for Yucca Mountain, and there have been claims that there would be assurances that it was safe before anything happened, that this would all follow due process that's set up with the scientific studies, the characterization of the site, the licensing that's required. And as each of these processes has hit a logjam or public opposition, then the rules have changed. So the people here have been operating under just a changing playing field ever since this thing started. And
how did Nevada get targeted to begin with?
Well, there was to be a national search for supposedly the best place to put high-level nuclear waste, and the government took off and went out in various parts of the country and began looking first at granite formations, and those turned out to be in the upper Midwest, in Minnesota and Wisconsin, and in the Northeast, in New Hampshire and Maine. And the people there just rose up and said, no, you can't even consider this sort of thing. So the government just kind of got pushed off of sites that it was looking at, and there was never any clear process for establishing this, for having people really consider what needed to be done, and wound up in Nevada where the test site already existed. And I think that they had the idea that because Nevadans had coexisted with the nuclear waste or the nuclear test site, that they would accept this facility. But we have situations just like Tom Bailey was talking about with people in Utah who are also downwinders and have suffered because of releases through testing. And they have many of the very same illnesses that he was talking about. And there's no reason to believe that you wouldn't just have another round of that sort of thing as a result of a facility here or possibly anywhere in the nation where you had transportation. If you had one of the train wrecks that we've seen a lot of lately, or if you had any kind of an incident, what we're saying is that if in fact the solution to this problem is the isolation of this waste and the protection of human health and safety, you're really putting more people at greater risk with the plan that they're talking about.
Can you tell us in Washington State, Tom Bailey, about the class action suit that you filed against the government? How many people you represent and what you're calling for?
Well, you got to remember that everything that we're dealing with is intentional. The government made a conscious decision to do this to us people, test on us people, and then they made a decision to keep it secret. We're suing for health care and health studies. Unfortunately, we'll probably end up just getting money, which isn't going to help a lot of people, but that's the way they meter out justice in this country.
How many of you are there?
There's about 2,800 of us left that are qualified for the suit.
Now, when the Department of Energy last year was forced, when Hazel O'Leary was forced to do these studies because more and more information was coming out on the deliberate experiments on U.S. citizens.
Human experimentation, right.
Were you included in that?
Yes, we're included in that.
Have you gotten any apology from the federal government?
Yes, President Clinton apologized to us.
How do you feel about that?
Well, that's a little late.
And
I really feel about it, not one downwinder's got a free X-ray or a thyroxine pill, which is what you take for thyroid medication. $48 million goes to the government's attorneys, $100 million here for studies, and people just keep dying. And that's their strategy, is just let us slowly die off. We'll eventually go away.
Well, let me ask, in this last round of questions, we really only have a minute, and let's start with you, Tom Bailey. How people, if they're interested in the case of Washington State, not to mention their own state and where nuclear waste is, how they can find out more information? Any suggestions?
Well, there's a book called Atomic Harvest by Michael D'Antonio, and the National Committee for Radiation Victims in Washington, D.C., run by Cooper Brown. Wally Cummins, 775-8786.
That's in Washington, D.C.?
That's correct.
202-775-8786. 8786. And Judy Treichel, Executive Director of the Nevada Nuclear Waste Task Force in Nevada. If people are interested in, for example, the Anti-Nuclear Summit next week or the work you're doing around the Nevada test site in Yucca Mountain, how can they reach you?
We have a toll-free number. It's 1-800-227-9809. And we would be happy to supply whatever information people want and just hear their opinions. And it doesn't matter what their opinions are. I'm only disturbed when people don't have an opinion at all.
And finally, Bill McGovern in Washington, D.C., as you do your lobbying on the Hill, any suggestions to listeners who are involved with nuclear waste struggles in their area or are concerned just generally about what's happening in other areas?
And win. We can win these fights because politicians are still afraid of radioactive waste, as they should be. And despite the money they get from the industry, if enough citizens rise up, we can force the politicians to care more about our health and safety than they do about bailing out the industry. So people should keep up the pressure on their members of Congress, their senators, and the administration, and tell them that They cannot justify the kinds of things that were done to Tom Bailey at Hanford and the kinds of things that the nuclear industry wants to do in Nevada and California. Our health has to come first.
Bill McGavern, thank you very much from Public Citizens Critical Mass Energy Project. And thank you to Chair Matthew Lavis, chair of the Chemehuevi Tribe in Southern California. His number in Southern California, 619-858-4301. That's 619-858-4301. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin with Pat Greenfield, engineered by Bernard White and Errol Maitland here in New York. I'm Amy Goodman. Thank you for listening to Democracy Now! Tomorrow we'll be looking at the Detroit news strike and also the Puerto Rican March on Washington that's happening. Join me tomorrow for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And if you'd like a tape of today's show, 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Thanks for listening.